So how did your fascination with birds begin, lad?
Oh, my God. It goes way back. But as a child, I was being brought up to know birds, to know nature. My immigrant parents, for whom that was absolutely essential, that defined somehow who they were, the Czech countryside and the Czech birds and all that, the Central European and all the migration. So I learned all these things bilingually, continually. But of course, I could never really be fully an American because we were in exile. But I'm also an American in the sense that I've really learned to know the landscape. I was brought to that probably by that exile of my parents. And now I know things about the place that I inhabit that very few people do because I've put so much effort into it, not just as a naturalist and as a scientist, but as an artist as well, as a spiritual seeker, one who looks for the native traditions as well. And this is why I also publish in Ojibwe, not because I speak the language, but because it needs to be honored as a piece of that place that we inhabit. So knowing the bird life, knowing them by song, being able to identify them by the least little chip, all of that is really important. In a lot of ways, it became something that became inculcated in me as a student going to Europe, as a Kalamazoo College student on foreign exchange. And I say that in the book here. I have a little passage there about being in Europe and rediscovering the culture of the old world that, of course, was given to me in a child's form until that point by my parents. Learning to rediscover my own Czech language, learning to speak good German, and finding out what it really means to be a European in a world inhabitant by visiting all the museums. And of course, you go in the bowl with your little backpack and you're a dirtbag student. You're doing all the stuff right and being a cheapskate and living next to nothing and walking as far as you can without paying for bus fare, even riding illegally, I'll admit, here and there. And I ended up somehow in the middle of all that in the Mauritshuis in The Hague in Holland and encountering this painting of a goldfinch, which apparently is now in a fairly popular book. So it's, I guess the goldfinch is everywhere right now. But Fabricius was an exquisite painter who came from the workshop of Rembrandt, and he did this painting of a goldfinch, a very simple, unassuming painting, but I encountered it, and something about the scales falling from my eyes happened there in the Mauritshuis. And I think I encountered what it was I was born to do, to treat nature, to find the spiritual aspect in it, and to do it as an artist. And it took me some years of being a scientist and doing all manner of other things before I came back to being an artist. And at some point, as an older, experienced hand, I put together this book in which I have things like goldfinches and all the stories that I've encountered by pursuing birds across lots and lots of landscape. Very simple the stories, lots of them. Some are convoluted, some are, you know, like I said, in exotic places. And I hope they entertain because the written word and spoken word are extremely important carrying culture. And yet, of course, they exclude a great many people who don't speak that language. The drawings, of course, transcend language. They are like ideograms. They have their abstract sides. I do have messages encoded within them. There are things I want to say, but they're subtle. Don't beat you over the head. They're not telling you what to think. And of course, I want to tell my stories around it. We all tell our stories. I care about language enough to have worked on being able to write in a decent form and have something to say, and I hope that carries through.
It does. It does. And you address also habitat loss and some of the changes you've seen in birding over a pretty much a lifetime, fair to say, how that's affected. And I'm wondering, too, back in the Czech Republic, what kind of birds are you seeing compared to what you're seeing here?
Europe is definitely more inhabited, more densely populated, and you really do see the difference between North America and Europe in the density of interesting, unusual birds. Birds that are specific to specific habitats, that aren't the generalists. They're hard to find. And in some ways, maybe the best way to see that is if you go someplace where those European or Eurasian birds are untouched. You go to Tibet, for instance, and there, where the people are vegetarians and in small numbers, and they live lightly upon the land, and they don't put any pesticides down, You see hoopoes and rollers and bee eaters and these exotic, wonderful jewel-like birds that are extremely rare in Europe today. You'll see them in every village. They'll be nesting in the apple trees and under the eaves, and the people there are completely comfortable with those birds around them at all times. Whereas when I'm in the Czech Republic or Austria or Germany, these are all places I've lived and studied, you'll never see a hoopoe. I look for these birds. I'm out there, and if I hear a bird that is unusual, I track it down to find out what bird is making that sound. And I'll tell you, I saw one hoopoe in Austria in all my life, and I think two in the Czech Republic. Mm. It's extremely rare. And then, if you go to no man's land, that place, that strip of land, that's in that militarized zone that lies between the East Bloc and the West Bloc, which I visited frequently, mostly illegally, poaching fish and things like that between military patrols, there, the absence of the human element, but for a few soldiers, has allowed a lot of those birds to proliferate and to return. So again, you see what things used to be like and what they might be like if we just let them. And the difference is astronomical. Now, here in North America, we haven't lost nearly as much as people typically in Europe have, but it's significant. In a fairly short time that I've been aware of birds and paying attention to it, in my maybe 50 years or so, or 45, that I've been from the age of 15 or 12, there has been such a diminution of those birds that require, again, very specific habitat, and those that haven't actually benefited from some sort of special protection program, and those that are migrants. So the migrants that go down into the Caribbean or into Central America, they're coming back, and you still see them, but they're in their much reduced numbers. And maybe a way I would bring that closer to home to you would be that, think about when they were all announcing that the frogs were disappearing. And you'd go out there and you'd hear the frogs in the pond croaking away and say, what do you mean? There's frogs. But if you just stop for a moment and try to catch a few, try to count how many there are, and you realize you are hearing frogs, but there's one, there's one, there's one. It's 5 or 10% of what there used to be. There used to be a cacophony of frogs, a symphony with all the chirping in their faces. Turn on the lights outside your house. There used to be screens on people's windows, right? And they served a purpose to keep the bugs out of your house. Well, there's no bugs out there anymore. You turn on the lights, there's almost no moths that come into them anymore. There are a few, but it's that 5 or 10% again. They still exist. They could still come back, but they are being beaten and beaten severely.
And you've also mentioned in the book that your eating habits changed a little bit, that you used to be quite the fowler. And when you talk about living lightly on the land, that now you don't eat. You still eat meat, but did birding change how you approach what you put on your dinner plate?
Oh, many things have. But ultimately, there's something exquisitely... there's something inhumane about the way we get our meat that I just can't participate in. You know, the slaughterhouses, the animals confined in the cages, you know, it all tastes good and all that. I like meat, but I just feel like I can't participate in that system, a system that requires so much land being dedicated to GMO-produced corn that then gets fed to these animals that are actually slowly dying, and the animals have to be slaughtered at a certain point in their lives because they will naturally die of the GMO crops and the corn that aren't natural to their system, and on and on and on. There are so many things that are documented that are all wrong with it that you at some point all of us have to wake up and realize that some part of the system bothers us enough not to participate. Probably beekeeping had as much to do with that for me as anything, and realizing that the whole system is killing bees, and I'm having a hard time keeping them alive. Well, I can't participate in any of that. You know, there's something in me that just keeps getting more and more sensitive as I get older and meditate more and try to live a more spiritual and open mind life, that I have to pay attention at some point and just stop eating these things, stop buying them.
You made a differentiation, though, in the book about buying your meat, say, in a supermarket or from one of these awful slaughterhouses that you just referred to, and perhaps doing that butchering yourself, that kill yourself. I believe you referred to it as it can be gruesome and beautiful at once.
Absolutely. It is natural to the human being to be an omnivore. You know, we are closest to the pigs in the way we eat and what we, you know, the variety of things that we can consume and that seem to do well by us and the variety we need to be healthy. But I think, yes, that there is something very concretely important in participating in all aspects of life. The specialist in us, I think, leads to sitting in front of a computer screen and getting unhealthy, you know, with your hunched back and all the problems. The specialist in us that gets very efficient at doing one thing over and over is the person who ends up with the problems with the wrist or the elbows, the frequent abuse of some joint. All of these things are opposite to what the human being ultimately craves. We are easily bored, monkey chattering people that just need to try this, try that, get up, go over there, do that. And that also includes, you know, gardening, beekeeping, hunting, fishing, traveling over there to see how those people live. All the stuff that just keeps you going, keeps you somehow interested and alive. And to me, that includes living not just lightly on the land, but that's important too, but also living on the land, being of the place that you inhabit, which includes dropping everything else because the mushrooms are growing right now. They're not going to be getting mushrooms 2 weeks from now. They'll all be rotten. They'll be, you know, deliquescent and filled with bugs. You don't want that. You want them fresh right now, just after the rain. You got to drop all that other silly stuff you're doing that's so incredibly important and go and pick mushrooms. And you fix the mushrooms and they're really good and you like them. And you look forward to the next year and the turn of the cycle. And the same thing happens when you're gardening. The same thing happens when there's waterfowl in migration and you pick up your fowling piece, maybe a dog, and go out and shoot a couple of ducks. I understand all that, and I've done a lot of it, and I value that in my life. But I've also seen the diminution in waterfowl and upland game birds. I just don't feel right killing them anymore, not because it's an immoral act, but because there just aren't very many of them left. And I can't be participating in doing that. But picking up a roadkill and, you know, butchering out a deer, yeah, I'll do that. Why
yeah,
not?
Yeah, yeah. And then you talk about how the birds do this, and there are times when people work together with nature. There's a section in here about vultures, and I was fascinated with the story of how in northern climes, where they're in these long, cold seasons and they can't bury their dead, and how they work together with the vultures to take care of the dead. Can you tell us about that?
That is a beautiful story. And I'd read about air burials and things. It takes place mostly in Central Asia, I think some of the Mongolian areas, but primarily Tibet. And it was suppressed for a long time by the Chinese, but when I was in Tibet, it was starting to make a comeback, and there were tourists going up to watch the sky burials, which, you know, seemed a little obscene to me. I guess I don't want to go and watch somebody else's Aunt Hattie be dismembered and fed to vultures. Well, I might like to, but I don't really want to intrude in someone else's life in that fashion. But what they do is the vultures have become accustomed to the Tibetans not being able to bury their dead in the winter because the ground is frozen for half the year and they're way up high and it's all rocky and flinty and difficult. And there is a trained class of monks who do nothing but, in the spring, dismember the bodies of the dead, cut them up, flens them as much as any butcher would to little pieces, and they slice the pieces of meat off the bones, feed them to vultures, which come in and gather in multitudes from across the Himalayan uplands, knowing that this takes place. And then they pound apart the bones that are left and put them into, make them into little pieces and feed the meal and the little crumbs and things to the vultures. And at some point, the whole of the person has been returned to nature in this quick fashion where they speak of finality and having some sort of closure about, you know, the death of your loved ones. Well, I think that's about as definitive as it gets. They're not buried. They're not coming awake in a coffin in some sort of Edgar Allan Poe fantasy. No, they've been cut to little pieces and fed to the vultures. And apparently somewhere in Tibet, they also do water burials to the fish where along the, what's it called? The Lapsung, the Po, well, that's the Brahmaputra in Hindu, but that's the main river that flows through Tibet and has a Tibetan name. But they do feed them to the fish, too, like that. There's something just so elegant about ending your days that way. And if there would be anyone with the guts to cut me to little pieces, I'd love to end up, you know, being fed to the vultures in that fashion.
I've always wanted, you know, the cremation and plant a tree so that I can become a part of that tree. So I like these cycles where it's not really an ending, but you become another part of nature. And then there's a wonderful section in here about raptors. You know, there's a certain fascination with birds that kill with such precision. There's a beauty even in that.
There's something about the absolute sovereignty of these creatures that are at the top of the food chain that aren't very aware of us or that interested. The absolute disinterest in us and our affairs is really wonderful. You know, we can kill them, we can compete with them, we can do all kinds of things with them, but we can't own them. They cannot be bought.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably something, especially in a civilized person, you know, from these highly hierarchic societies where we're used to someone always, you know, running things and telling us what we have to do and can't do. And you know, the minute you think that you're in control, you find out that there's someone yet higher above you that has control over you anyway, or that there's an economic system or set of rules that stop you from doing anything. You know, you hold it against the president that he didn't do this and he didn't do that. Well, it turns out that even the president of the United States isn't all that terribly powerful. And it goes on and on and on until you stop and you realize that any little backyard kestrel or red-tailed hawk on a telephone pole is absolute sovereign. There is no one above them. They do exactly what they want. They are absolutely free. They don't care what you do, and they kill with what they need, and they have no compunctions about it. It's a very cold, calculated, needed thing. They eat. They're done. They stop killing.
Yeah.
And you cannot buy them.
There's something, too, that I recall from childhood, going to bird sanctuaries and zoos and seeing birds in cages. And then the first time I traveled north to Alaska and up in the Haines area, seeing hundreds of eagles out there. And the first time I saw one fly over me, and then I'd realized I'd never seen an eagle before. It didn't count what I had seen until that moment, because seeing them in flight, seeing that wingspan, you know, up until then, I realized I'd never seen one in flight.
Gosh, it's like I was in the zoo in La Paz, Bolivia, where they keep a few condors in a cage. And, you know, condors are way up there. I mean, once in a while you'll see one, but it's that they're at the edge of sight. It's kilometers up in the air, and, you know, their eyesight is perfect. They can see us and, you know, checking you out for signs of life and all that. But the condors have a wingspan that's in that 12-foot range, just absolutely
amazing, immense.
But there they are on the ground, looking around and eating some dead rabbits or whatever they threw in there. And if you reach in through the cage, it's like touching basketry or something, like the slats on an ash basket. I mean, it's just you knock on the bird and it bong, bong, bong in there. It's just amazing how stiff and protected they are, and how large, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
But sort of like that eagle, you've seen them somewhere, but it takes you by surprise when you see it in its own habitat, or you start to realize what the essence of this creature is.
Are you able to tell what a bird is just from the sound?
Yes, but don't sound all that surprised. That's bird watchers all do that. Basically,
I
can't, any of us,
and
any
that
of us
fascinates
that,
me, that
of course
skill.
You could if you took a little time with
it.
Well,
maybe a few.
What happens is typically, you know, if we start doing censusing work, and you really have to keep track of what's in a habitat. Well, if you just limit yourself to what you can see, it's going to be always distorted. You really do need to know bird song if you're going to take it seriously in order to have some kind of overview of what's there, so you know how many territories there are, where the territories overlap, and what song there is, and what, you know, call notes they are, whether it's in breeding season or otherwise. All that plays a role. But here, I'll give you a story. That's a funny one. Because I'm like that with the birding. I used to teach ornithology at Colorado State University and shortly at K College. You know, I'm a birder, and I actually monitored nuclear power plant in Colorado for the bird life, and that involved exactly this kind of censusing where you had to know the territories and the song. So I was in Hawaii just on vacation, but, you know, of course, paying attention to the birds, and I heard this really loud sound off in the bushes, very familiar, but, you know, just, wow, that's amazing. What bird is making that much noise? And this bird was very elusive. It kept jumping up ahead of me and was scurrying around the underbrush, and I couldn't find it. I must have spent half an hour tracking down this bird until I found a good look at it, and it was a cardinal, which is a bird that any beginning birder knows absolutely, but out of context in Hawaii. I wasn't expecting a cardinal in Hawaii. So, you know, there I'm caught, you know, with them. oh, wow, chasing a cardinal around for half an hour in Hawaii.
Yeah.
Which is an introduced exotic bird there, which, you know, no one actually wants to support having them there, but they got loose somehow.
And, you know, I hadn't realized that there are so many warblers. That's something I learned from your book. I looked at all these beautiful illustrations, and I thought there were one or two.
Yeah, warblers. They are, you know, what fly fishing is to fishing, or, you know, they're what the aficionado does. We get all into warblers. And, of course, and I must admit that that's where I start to fall short. I don't know all the warbler songs either, and I get confused. When you get immatures in the fall migration, you know, that are really hard to tell apart and they're not in full plumage, that's the mark of an absolute maniac, the kinds of people who fly around the world and do life lists of birds and stuff. They can spot all this stuff and they know it. And the rest of us have to refresh our memories again. What does a redstart sound like every spring? Or you forget other birds and suddenly you're listening. Sort of like that cardinal that I mentioned in Hawaii.
Yeah.
You're listening, what the heck? And of course, it's a yellow-throat, a very common warbler, but you haven't heard it since the last summer.
Yeah.
And so it comes back to you, and yeah. But the warbler is a wonderful thing, and of course, they're little jewels. They're sort of they're New World birds, so it's just America.
Yeah.
And you know, of course, people from Europe come here all excited to see warblers. That's a big deal for them, and they're common here. It's one of the things, you can go out in a spring morning when the peak of the migration is there, maybe see 20, 30 different kinds of warblers in the bushes. If you really look hard, you know, just go into Kleinstock Preserve, you know, 30 is maybe a little bit high, but there certainly had mornings when I've seen 25, 28 species of warblers in one morning, be buzzing away and chasing little gnats and things up in the buds of the oak trees.
So we're talking about Lad the birder, but I want to talk also about Lad the artist. Talk to us about what we see in this beautiful book, the kind of art. There's sketch studies and illustrations and etchings and a little bit more about the technique and the process and your approach as an artist.
Oh, of course. Glad to do that. I found that it serves my purposes to occasionally publish a catalog of my artwork. Helps to promote what I do, helps me to put my ideas in order, start generating enough thought to put together concept into story. And a compendium of all these things is something that people like. And so I thought about all the birds I'd done over the years. There must be hundreds of drawings and etchings of birds that I've done. And I pulled together quite a few of them into one volume and started writing about it. And people here are mostly used to seeing my etchings come from, you know, done in copper plates and inks, you know, the various viscous inks, very black and white, very graphic images. But those etchings all come from many studies, many drawings that are done in the field. And it's very interesting to look at that. Typically, when we artists get together, we look at each other's sketchbooks, you know, the finished work, you know, oil painting, stuff like that. For pikers, give me that sketchbook. Let's see how you handle line, you know. That's where the mastery comes in. You know, we love that. And so I try to share that. It's hard to exhibit, you know, very simple sketches and drawings, even though I and my colleagues know that that's actually where the gold is. That's the good stuff. And yet few people take it that seriously. But in a book like this, this is a place where I can show some of the process, you know, some of the lines and the drawings that went into making etchings and then the finished product. And the other thing you'll see in there is some of these etchings I've then placed into beehives to let the bees build honeycomb on them. So you see the etching, you see the drawing that went into making it, then the etching, and then what happens when the bees have their way with it. So that's fun too. Maybe to back up, a few years ago I had an art dealer up north, Tom X. He's from here actually, from Kalamazoo. But he ran a gallery, and he was doing very well for me throughout the summer when there's lots and lots of tourists up in Houghton, Hancock, and a pretty terrible time for him in January and February when the wolf with the door was after him, and he kept begging me to stop sending him dead fish and, you know, winter trees, and can't you send me something I can sell? Come on, lad, give me a nice chickadee on a branch, something for the bird feeder fancier. Well, yeah, okay, I did that. I did him some chickadees, I did him some... I don't know, cardinals and robins. A bunch of birds that would help them sell. And it was, I admit, to a mercenary impulse and all that. You know, there is the piper to pay and the, you know, the rent to pay and all that sort of thing. And artists are also known to be mercenaries at times, too. So I did them a whole bunch of birds, and they sold pretty well. But then I got into my birds. I loved them. I've been involved in birding all my life. And so then that didn't stop. And then I started doing all these warblers. And, well, you know, take away the color. Do them in black and white. And they become something else. They became studies in graphic studies in black and white rather than in color. And they're like harlequins. There's all these interesting patterns there. And if you start really looking at warblers, they're not all alike. A chat sits very differently and has a very different attitude and posture than does a redstart that is very different from a hooded warbler. They just seem to all be the same with slightly different colors on them until you really start looking. And that gets interesting. So that this whole thing morphed into my doing several hundred etchings of various little sparrows and wood warblers. And yeah, the poor art dealer, Tom, you know, he did well for a little while and then went bust anyway. But I did try to help save him and pull him out of the fire, and it helped me. I, you know, they've been sort of a little bread and butter for me.
Yeah.
But, it, you know, beyond any sort of impulse to make money, which is, you know, we make jokes out of it, but it really is about some sort of a deeper pursuit of that which is around us. It's not any different than going out picking mushrooms and then gardening and all the other many things that we do that get us out of the door every day and in touch with the place we live. And the reason I tell all these stories in there is, again, the experience that I have with art galleries and museums. I think, you know, all of us have been to an outdoor art show with, you know, the people going around texting and disciplining their children and needing snow cones and hardly glancing at the artwork. And you find as an artist that you resent all these people after a while, and you resent yourself even more for resenting them in the first place when they're just doing what comes natural to them. And on it goes. But you are a part of bringing it all around, of using nature in that way and bringing some kind of knowledge in or experience in for those other people.
And we've touched just lightly and in passing on the beekeeping. It's mostly a book about birds, but you've mentioned that the beekeeping. And towards the end of the book, there's a combination of the insects and the birds. Talk a little bit more about that. And last year, or was it 2014, that you had an art prize entry that combined etchings and your artwork with what the bees do?
Fellow writer Tom Springer walked in the door one day and put a box of bees on the table and a bunch of wood and said, here, you can make yourself a beehive out of that, and you need to be a beekeeper. And I was a beekeeper. Little things were there on my table in front of me, you know, in a little big box. Well, not that big a box, about 3 pounds of bees, which was maybe 3,000 bees, and they're all sticking their little tongues out through the mesh, and I'd put a little bit of honey on my finger and put it there for them to lick off. And it's just the most endearing thing, and I couldn't, you know, it's like somebody handing you a puppy and it's too cute to ever give back. You become a dog owner at that point. So I've kept bees, and for me, it's like many of you taking up something that makes your life a little fresh again. You know, you become stale. You're doing the same thing every day. It must be it's 7:30. The alarm's ringing. You're out the door. You got to do something to shake it up a little bit. So beekeeping was that for me. But you know, I also am still an artist, and on one hand, I have the bees. On the other hand, I have my artwork, and I put the two together, like two hands together, and it just seemed like the most self-evident thing in the world to see what would happen if I mixed them. And of course, there's magic that happens in those moments. You do what seems self-evident and find out that no one else has done it. Well, I guess any good idea, somebody came up with it the first time, and it's not as on some kind of a genius for it. It seems self-evident. But I did this for several years, and the results were absolutely stunning and also unpredictable, which is something I think most of us also lack in life, is the unpredictable that we crave at some level. Maybe that's why casinos are full of people. I don't know. In any case, I did that. I have several hundred of these pieces with my bees, and I took them to Art Prize because it just seemed like the most perfect thing to just put living bees in the museum with all these things and let people watch it happen. And they did. They came and droves, and they loved watching it. It was amazing to see, you know, everything, little school groups with their noses pasted up against the glass, to, you know, grannies and grandpas there looking just like little kids. You know, suddenly all that jadedness drops off of them, and they're just looking at 10,000 cute fuzzy little bees, just, you know, a quarter inch from their nose.
And it was a wonderful opportunity to talk to people, I imagine, about bee colony collapse and how important the bees are to our survival. And I remember seeing that piece in Grand Rapids at that time, and that people were alarmed that they would see some dead bees, and you had to explain what was going on.
I did. There were people who held it against me that I was really abusive of the bees, because there were windrows of dead bees in there, but they only live 4 or 5 weeks in nature.
Yeah.
That's the lifespan of a bee. They work very hard. They use up those little bodies. Except for the queen. She'll live several years. And she lays somewhere in the order of 1,500 to 2,000 eggs a day, which is her own weight per day. That's the equivalent to a woman bearing 12 babies a day or something. It's just, it isn't just exorbitant crazy. It's just absolutely incomprehensible how it's possible to do something. I just, how can you put together that much organized, high quality anything and push it out of your body and do it day after day after day after day? I don't understand how that's even possible. But in any case, that is what happens. Life is profligate. It's short. It's intense. And they keep breeding new ones. So any bee I would have brought in 2 or 3 weeks later, if it was adult when I brought in, should be dead. And all the bees that are, most of the bees that were in the exhibit should have been born in the exhibit by the time I closed it.
Yeah.
So it was life and death, the whole cycle happening there in front of you. And it was beautiful. Of course, I had to go in and clean it occasionally at night. And, you know, nobody in the department of bean counting could know about that. Me and my friends in hazmat suits going around and catching the last stragglers around the museum lest somebody gets stung. It was absolutely hilarious dealing with the administration there, and really rewarding to realize how many people do indeed pay attention to what is happening, that the bees really are in trouble and we need to do something about that, and that they were there. A lot of people came to that show to express support as much as they did to see the exhibit. It was a fascinating thing to have happen, but it does tie us right back to, you know, making choices in the food you eat. Do you want to support a pesticide-intensive agricultural system that kills the bees, that then, you know, in a feedback loop, you know, slowly pinches off the pollination potential for bees and orchards, and maybe impoverishes the food choices we have to things that don't need pollination? And on it goes. You just have to keep living consciously. And I can tell you how I choose to live consciously and what I choose to eat, but I don't think that's nearly as important as it is for you to be involved, do some reading, and make choices as to what sacrifices you're willing to take and which ones push your buttons. Which of those sacrifices seems like way too much just because you happen to like it? And, you know, I mean, I'm guilty as much as anyone else. I just, a nice juicy beefsteak. It's just so good. But I don't really need it. There's no reason I need to eat those beefsteaks and support an industry that is absolutely cruel in the way it handles livestock. Or I can pay maybe several times as much money and get something that's organically grown by some local farmer that loves his Bessie and has to look the other way while somebody else kills Bessie and makes meat out of her. I don't have all the answers, but I do know that the answers come from that kind of investigation.
And then I love the stories that also come towards the end of the book. There's some real adventure there where your birding stories in Eastern Europe in these military sectors. Can you share maybe a portion of a little taste of one of those?
They're
fascinating.
Yeah.
And there's even a Keystone Cop story there.
Yeah, that was pretty fun. I was bird watching in, it was in Romania, actually. I'd somehow made it through all the various borders and the train stations in Romania, for instance, during the Ceausescu regime had no lights on. They were saving energy, right? So you couldn't tell actually where the station was and where to get on or off. And since I don't speak Romanian, I had to do the best I could with some broken Spanish to try to come closer, you know, high school Latin, that sort of thing. And it was difficult, but I ended up in some little place called Babadag. It was a mostly Turkish-speaking village, and I was chasing birds around the people's backyards and gardens. And it was sort of like I described in Tibet and other places where, you know, pesticides aren't used, and you'll see rare, really rare, beautiful birds. I know, barn owls, which used to be common, you know, everywhere. You'd look at an old Baroque painting, and there'd be all these dead birds that are just exquisite, and all the children knew them, everybody knew them, and today they're rare. Well, in Baba Dag, that little Turkish village in Romania, there were all these rare birds. So I was chasing around people's backyards, and I got busted by the local cop for what? For taking photographs of shabby village architecture instead of cinder block buildings. Well, they hauled me into the station. I got just interviewed, and, you know, it was like classic film noir with these kind of Mutt and Jeff team of guys that were taking turns being good cop and bad cop with me. You know, one of them, I remember, was studying my passport, and after a while he turned it right side up and studied it some more, and then he looks at me and he takes this dramatic puff on his cigarette and stubs it out and gets up like Humphrey Bogart and so, "Mr. Kalamazoo, so what is it in this place that you think is so fascinating? I'd probably love to tell those people back at CIA how shabby our lives are. We live in these village architecture, these old buildings falling apart, you know, carved gables and thatched huts. We're not so dumb, you know. We know what you're up to." And on this thing went, and friend I was traveling with was spoke good Romanian. He was translating for me. But yeah, it's just amazing what you run into, the suppositions that were there to subvert the regime by looking at really beautiful village architecture and painted gables and, you know, carved lintels over the doorways, and they attribute all the wrong motives to us.
I can relate to some of that. As a young person going to the Soviet Union with a camera in hand, I got into trouble a couple of times too, and it was an education for a teenager, I tell you.
Hey, another one. I learned to smuggle doing exactly that.
There you go.
Because I lived in Vienna for a while, went to art school, and visited relatives in Prague all the time. So back and forth, you know, smuggling all kinds of, you know, forbidden literature and things. But I learned, if you don't want the authorities on the train or the cops to spot what you have, you hide it in plain view. You know, the copy of Solzhenitsyn that they were going to nab, well, I was reading that while the cops were in the train looking at all my other stuff. I just have it on my lap and I was reading it, and they were checking my baggage. Well, or if I had some expensive photo gear that I didn't want to pay customs on, well, I would put it in the top of my backpack. And so when they come in and the customs want to check what I have with me, well, I would reach into the backpack, pull out the expensive camera gear, put it on the seat next to me so they could look around in the bottom of my backpack.
There you go.
And they always left me alone.
And I remember doing some tricks of staying in a bugged hotel, and we knew that pretty quickly. Radios, telephones, you know, that kind of a thing, wherever tourists were. When I needed a clean towel or a fresh roll of toilet paper, you just stood in the middle of your room and asked for it, and lo and behold, it appeared.
Subtle.
Yes. And then the last page, there's this wonderful stuff, end of book. And I was wondering, in fact, Lad, if you might not read one or two of these.
Well, I suppose I could
do that.
And
tell us what they are.
Well, let's take us back to my K College days. I'm an alum of the place, and I love Kalamazoo College. And I go there periodically to the rare book room where Paul Smithson reigns supreme, and he puts together these exhibitions. They're rare gems that very few people know about, but they have an incredible collection of rare books there. Actually, there's one. Paul has put together a collection of some of the books they own of mine. It's a little secret of mine that I do all these book arts. I mostly show them elsewhere than Kalamazoo, but here and there. In any case, they collect them, and they put out a bunch of mine, and they're up for the next 3 months in the Todd Rare Book Room, and you can go there. It'll be part of the Art Hop in October, so that's the way to see it probably best. Or just go up there and talk to Paul. He doesn't bite. He's a nice guy. He's been haunting the place. He swears that when he dies, he will continue to haunt the place, that they will have to have an exorcism to get rid of him. In any case, I was up there once for one of these shows, and he had a book of anathemas. And that just fascinated me. I started reading them. And what they are curses that traditionally are placed at the back of a book Medieval monks particularly did that back when books were extremely valuable because they were written by hand and it took years to transcribe. Well, those people took great umbrage at somebody stealing or defacing the book, or even, you know, writing little notes in the margins, or handling them with dirty hands. And so a lot of these medieval books would have in the back something that the last monk to handle it had written in there, cursing you to eternal damnation or pain or something for having stolen this book. And there, so I took a few of these anathemas and I placed them in here, just to remind us how that goes. And oh, a typical one here from the Abbey of St. Mary's Nicholas of Arnstein. If anyone taketh this book, let him die the death. Let him be boiled in a cauldron. Let the falling sickness and fever seize him. Let him be broken on the wheel and hanged. Amen. Wow, that's strong stuff. Well, of course, I don't just quote other people's anathemas. I had to write one. I had to add one, too, for my bird book. So here, for this book of birds, an avian anathema. For those who take and don't return this book I bought, whose loss I'd mourn. May avian flu infest your bowels, and ugly wattles hide your jowls. May all your privates host the crabs, and rooks and ravens pick the scabs. Because you dare to steal my tomes, may vultures descend and pick your bones.
I love it. So if we don't get to steal your book, where can we get it?
Oh, yeah, there are many possibilities. One, of course, is just to come to my studio sometime. Another is to go to Kazoo Books. They have them. The Book Bug has them. The Nature Connection has them downtown on the mall. They're actually doing an opening for me, the next Art Hop in October. The one in Paul Smithson and Kay College is a November Art Hop. Let's see, the Kalamazoo Institute of Arts shop has them. The chocolate shop, the Confections with Convictions has them. Michigan News Agency, Kalamazoo Nature Center.
Pretty much everywhere.
I hit them all. And, of course, art galleries, wherever I show my artwork. That's the primary venue, actually. I mostly did this as a way to bring this closer to those who are actually interested in my artwork. Because a typical person buys themselves a print. You know, you have a print, nice one on the wall, maybe two or three if you're really into this. But you're not going to buy all 200 of my etchings, and yet this is a way for you to pad that out. You've got a couple of nice bird prints at home, then you have all the stories that go with it, and a compendium volume that goes with it that shows you all the books and all the stories and why I did them, and there's a little something about every bird in there, and you know, keep you entertained.
Well, it's a proud possession on my bookshelf. Thank you for coming in today, lad.
Well, you're very welcome, Cynthia.